listening to Not So Live from Asteroid G. I'm Mike Finkelstein. With me, well, actually not with me as always, because my normal co-hosts aren't here. They're all sick with COVID. And so instead we're doing an interview session today, and I am in the booth with, well, I know you as ADR. I'm not sure if you want to go by another name or not.
Yeah, those are actually just my initials. My regular name is Adam D. Rube.
Okay. So Adam, and we'll go with that. That's easy enough for me to remember. I'm pretty sure I can't fuck that up. So I know you from the Final Fantasy Randomizer community. You joined up a little while ago. I think you did the Duck stuff for a little bit, our new player showcase stuff. And then you've kind of become a general programmer for just about everything we need at this point to run the community as a whole. What got you interested in Final Fantasy Randomizer?
Okay, yeah. In 2020 September, my baby was born, my little daughter. And that meant I was up late a lot of nights. And since I'm holding her, I figured I could stick a controller in my hand and play some old video games. I've been meaning to play Final Fantasy IX again since like 2002 and finally took that chance. Well, after finishing the game, I just turned on some YouTube to kill time and it started suggesting to me these Final Fantasy videos. So, sure, I took one thing led to another, and next thing you know, it's Final Fantasy Randomizer Spring Tournament 2020 that it was showing me. And I just ended up watching it all and joined the Discord.
It is easy to get lost in all the videos that we have for it on YouTube. There's a ton. I know that's what drew me in, like, 2 years ago was the all the YouTube stuff we had for, like, 2017 and 2018 Spring Tournaments and they haven't been able to get rid of me since.
Yeah, I really was surprised myself a bit. I thought maybe I'd stick around for a month and get sick of it. And now we're over a year later, and, you know, I'm still enjoying it.
Well, it's a good community. It's a good group of people hanging out there. Yeah. So you like the Final Fantasy series. I'm getting that from the fact that it wasn't just Randomizer you were doing. You started off with wanting to go back to Final Fantasy IX. Is that a series you visit regularly? Is that one of your favorites? Do you have some other video game series instead you like?
Yeah, I've enjoyed Final Fantasy through the 90s. And actually, I haven't played very many new games since then. So in my mind, Final Fantasy X is still a new one I never got around to.
Yes.
Yeah, I still play some of the old Dragon Warrior and Mario on the NES too. Perfect Dark on the N64 I enjoy. So it's a nice little collection of those 90s games.
Yeah, we are very far away from Final Fantasy X at this point. I think that's the game that's usually used in the meme, what you think Final Fantasy looked like 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like it makes you feel old when you realize that. But I mean, that whole era of them, the classic games and then I guess the PlayStation ones are considered classics at this point. But, like, I consider them a different group, 7 through 9, maybe 10, the ones that can be played on that console. Those have themselves a certain following right there. I think the game's really kind of changed with 10 on those, so it's not the same thing that you might be used to from the classic era.
Yeah, one of the big differences is voice acting. Mm-hmm. And I still enjoy getting in arguments with people over how do you pronounce some of the old names. And no one really knows. Whereas in the new ones, the voice director just came down and said, this is how we're doing it. Yep. Everyone's heard it. There's no question anymore.
Yep.
Kids these days, they'll never know the struggle.
I mean, I played Final Fantasy VII, the US edition. It's always going to be Aeris. I do not care what other people say.
Me too.
Someone agrees with me. There you go. Like all the fanboys online being, it's Aerith with a TH. No, that's how it... No, sorry. Sorry, I can't buy that.
And you know, if you get into the Japanese language, it's not exactly either. So.
Well, there is that as well. Oh, so, computer programmer by day, are you?
Yeah.
So, like, I'm assuming that, like, degree for that and so forth, and that was something that inspired you?
Actually, I went to college for physics.
Oh.
And I ended up doing 1 year of that. I missed home. So when I got back for summer vacation, I just kind of never went back there and left it unfinished. So shortly after that, I went in and I put in a job application at McDonald's, and they rejected me. So now I'm like, well, this is bad. My dad's like, you gotta figure something out with your life. And someone I knew from a Star Wars versus Star Trek website, of all the random things, he said, "Hey, I heard you can make programs. Do you want to help me with something?" And I was like, okay. And then he connected me to someone, and I kind of fell ass backwards into being a programmer.
I mean, that's a good way to do it, though. I did go to a college for a degree in art, but somehow I end up doing websites, and that's my primary thing now. Like, I have a piece of paper that says I can do it, but at the same time, I'm like, but is that really what the piece of paper says?
Yeah.
So but it's something that you're passionate about. You do a lot of programming just as a hobby in your free time. The number of projects you have going for the randomizer at this point is pretty astounding.
Yeah, I do a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I've built up a nice collection of homemade software libraries and techniques that a lot of people like. They look at it and they say, "What is up with your crazy code?" I have one file that's 23,000 lines long, to give you an idea. But to me, like it makes enough sense. I've been doing it long enough now that I can dabble in and make sense of almost anything given a little bit of time.
Hmm. That's kind of cool. I like that.
So one of the reasons I got into programming is I wanted to make my own version of Final Fantasy One, and I never actually got around to it. I've done many pieces of it, but never actually like put it all together into a game. And now when I see what the randomizer is able to do, just taking the old ROM and changing a thing here or there, some of the hacks, changing artwork, you can make the game look completely new. And now I wish I got into that earlier, because I probably would have had a real blast with it.
I mean, there are plenty of things that the development crew are always looking for people to do. And if you're looking for ideas, I'm sure I can come up with some for you. But yeah, no, the randomizer itself is pretty incredible at this point.
Oh, yeah. And just in the last year that I've been here, it's incredible seeing everything change. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, as the number of new features that get added into it. It's one of the reasons why I described Final Fantasy Randomizer as one of the deepest and broadest randomizers that are out there. And I will shill for it. I mean, it's a free program, but I will absolutely shill for it every chance I get.
And I think Final Fantasy One is a really good candidate for this, too, because the original game was already, like, there's just enough story to give you an idea, but not so much that you do it out of order and it stops making sense. The game's not really an open world, but kind of is, because you can jump ahead in the original game, too. So there's just a lot of pieces there that gives you a chance to play.
Yeah, once you get past, like, the first, I'd say, quarter of the game, you're pretty open to go through the title any direction you want. I know when I first played the game, I had the little NES strategy guide that came packed in with it from Nintendo Power when I bought the game as a whole package from them. And, like, the ability there, like, you read through it, you're sitting there going, I don't have to go to Volcano right now. There's nothing, there's literally nothing that's valuable in Volcano right now. And I just kind of, you know, went off in my own direction, went for the airship, did other stuff. And I'm like, I'll get back to you later, Carrie. You don't need me right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would like to jump ahead and get the Excalibur as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's knowing how that weapon should work. Oh, that's a great sword if you can get it. Of course, you know, you have to know how it should work.
Yeah.
The original NES game wasn't entirely properly coded.
You know, I give the programmer a lot of slack, though, because he was working under... Yeah, he had a strict... deadline that he had to meet. And then given the environment, like my understanding is he didn't speak very much Japanese and he's working for a Japanese company. So that's gotta be a little bit awkward. He wasn't an RPG fan either. So you can imagine they're trying to explain a concept to him, and between the language barrier and his lack of playing in that genre, he's like, okay, I think I get it, and then codes it up, and when it's buggy, he doesn't have necessarily the experience to realize that. But he did manage to bring it all together, so I think it's really cool.
It was largely functional, and that's I mean, good enough that it became a smash hit for Square when it came out.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to look at that one in comparison to pretty much all the other ones, because from, like, Final Fantasy II on, the games got very linear, and there's not a lot of that kind of sequence breaking you can do. Like, anytime that they allow the game to really open up and get off the rails... it tends to happen near the end game. They're like, okay, here's a bunch of quests you can do. Now go do them or not as you see fit. Like, I mean, Final Fantasy 4, 5, Chrono Trigger, they all kind of had that feel. I know Final Fantasy 13 gets a lot of crap for being basically the linear hallway simulator, but like most of the games that Final Fantasy are in Final Fantasy series feel like linear hallway simulators. If you really just look at what you're supposed to do, you can't jump ahead all that much.
That was my big criticism of Final Fantasy IX when it came out. Mm-hmm. You can just hold up and A and you'll make your way through it. When I replayed it, like, I wasn't being fair to it at all. Mm-hmm. There is more to it than that. But it's also, you're right, it is somewhat true. When you get in the world map, you can look around, but there's only one destination to they funnel you in.
Yeah, it's like with Final Fantasy VII, I played that one. And there was just enough openness there that, like, you could follow the main storyline, or you could go over to the town to get Yuffie if you realized she was there, or you could hunt for Chocobos. That was really about it. But it's like, once you started doing the main storyline, you had to do mission after mission, and there was no bouncing off of it. So a lot of the Final Fantasies are kind of just constructed that way. Final Fantasy XIII gets crap for it. I don't know if that's really fair or not, but how do you shake that in a game without just making a completely open world? Of course, most of the randomizers that turn the games into open world things, they basically have to ditch the entire plot line to make it happen.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you look at a Dragon Warrior 3, that one, once you get the ship, it really does open up and you can pick up the orbs in whatever order. But on the other hand, it's so easy to get lost in that game.
It is.
Like, literally, you're sailing somewhere, you're just in the middle of ocean, you got random battles every 5 seconds, and you're completely disoriented. So there is a gameplay, like, it can make the game more fun to have at least some guidance. So I understand why the designers lean that way.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I think there's just a way that the NES games were built that they kind of had to do things like that the later games could avoid. I mean, any of the games from, like, I know Final Fantasy VII did, I think Final Fantasy VI had one as well, just the mini map that's right there on the screen so you know where you are at all times. Like, something like that in Dragon Warrior 3 would be super useful, but you are right. I watch people play that game, and they're like, well, we're going to go over here. I'm like, how do you even know you're there? They go, well, you know, I just know I'm supposed to go 20 tiles over this way. And then I sail up for 2 minutes, and suddenly I'm at the destination. I'm like, how did you learn that originally? Did you just walk off of a guide? And who figured that out? Because this is insane.
So I never realized until I got online that the map in Dragon Warrior 3 is based on the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back, it's kind of obvious all the names are kind of based on it, too. But now that I know that, it does help to navigate a little. If I'm trying to get to the new world, okay, now I know that's off to the west of the fake Europe. But yeah, I spent a lot of time playing that game in the old days, just being lost in the ocean.
Yeah. I remember, I know there's a lot of RPGs that I've played in the past. The ones that I enjoyed were the ones that were, you know, not very linear. But a lot of them, like, even when they're not linear, they kind of devolve into dungeon crawls of a certain extent. You can go wherever you want, but all you're really going to do is explore a map and fight monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not sure that the RPG genre really has ever gotten past the dungeon crawly aspects of itself, though.
You know, I played a Final Fantasy Mystic Quest again last year, too. And I appreciate a lot of what that game tried to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just the dungeons and monsters, even though that's still the majority of it, but just adding in those things like the hook or the jump, it made the game feel fresh. And the fact that you could kill all the monsters and then wander the dungeon at will without all the constant interruptions, I thought that was really cool.
I like that system. I think, like, it stands with the monsters being set up the way they are. It stands as a kind of a midpoint to what Chrono Trigger was eventually going to do with the encounters that you can see, and sometimes you can avoid them. I appreciate that system better, because it doesn't feel random and like the game is just purposely spiking you over and over again.
Yeah.
And I like the elements that they borrowed from, like, the Final Fantasy Adventure and Secret of Mana for Mystic Quest. Honestly, Mystic Quest is a game that just doesn't get as much appreciation as I think it really deserves.
Yeah, I would agree. I do think part of the game is a little bit boring. Like, once you figure out a few of the techniques, you just use it over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think that it tried to be more than it ended up being, but it still ended up being solidly okay.
If it had been called Mystic Quest with the Square name attached to it, I think it probably would have sold better. And been better appreciated, because it wouldn't have the expectation that it's still a Final Fantasy game.
Well, on the other hand, the name sells. The reason I got it is I really wanted Final Fantasy 2 or 3.
Yeah.
And my dad couldn't find it at the store. He said, oh, this has the same name. I'll grab that one instead.
That's fair. I mean, I think Square learned their lesson there as well with Chrono Trigger, because that one is one that borrows just enough elements from the overall Square Enix, like, library. The way they name things, certain spell elements, things like that are just traditionally Square. But they didn't apply the, like, they didn't call it Final Fantasy Chrono Quest or something, which maybe if Mystic Quest had, they might have done that.
That would have been weird.
It was, I mean, you can see they kind of consider it an offshoot of the series, so they packed it in with Final Fantasy IV on the PlayStation at the when it came out for the chronology, whatever they, that thing.
Yeah, they call that Anthology.
Thank you. Anthology was a different one, but there were so many of those that were on that system. I got them all. They're great collections. I love those collections.
That's how I played Final Fantasy IV, because I never actually did get it for the Super Nintendo. And so I got a copy for the PlayStation, and I thought it was nice. It had, what astounds me about that is on the same set, you had Final Fantasy IV, which worked well, and then the Chrono Trigger port, which is really laggy and slow.
Yeah, and it was weird.
It really hurt the game a lot.
Yeah, I think that one suffered because, unlike with Final Fantasy 1 and 2, and then probably like a little bit of 5 and 6 when they did those ports, they could run those on the same base of the engine. But Chrono Trigger being so different from Final Fantasy 4 and released basically in a different era of the Super Nintendo entirely, they had to basically do two engines for that game to make those games to make it run in the same collection. Didn't work as well, so the Chrono Trigger suffered for it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I still own it, though. I love that. I have every edition of Chrono Trigger. That is such a great game.
Chrono Trigger I did get on the Super Nintendo, and it's one of... In fact, it's the only game I really played on it. I was more of a Sega Genesis kid. But I saw Chrono Trigger. A friend brought it over one day. And it was just such a beautiful game. And the music was just mesmerizing to me. So I had to have it.
Yeah. No, it's a great one. It is the soundtrack that sells it. But there's so much just fine detail put into that game. It's astounding.
Yeah.
But you're a Sega Genesis fan then, so more Phantasy Star and Shining Force?
Oh, yes. You know, I watched a YouTube that was talking about the greatest RPG ever made, and he put Chrono Trigger at slot 2. And at first, I'm like, I'm going to dislike and cancel this guy for blasphemy. And then he said number 1, Phantasy Star 4. And I'm like, maybe I won't dislike it, because that's an arguable choice.
It's an arguable choice. It is, like, it's the one that Phantasy Star fans hold up more than air. They tend to dismiss Phantasy Star 3 for the weird things that it did, and it's like offshoot storyline. But then they go, but Phantasy Star 4, that is a brilliant game. I'm like, I can see that. It's pretty good. I mean, most of my Phantasy Star exposure was the online series, which is drastically different. But I like what the games do in general, and I think, like, they feel different enough from the RPGs that I think a lot of people are used to. They have a vibe that's much more Shin Megami in their style than at least for the battles than any of the traditional NES ones that I can normally think of. It's a cool hybrid kind of concept of overworld exploration with those first person-y kinds of fights, and it's very distinctive.
Yeah, it is. Phantasy Star 3 is actually one of the first games I got. Again, I really wanted 4, but, you know, we were on a budget, so my dad looked at it and he's like, well, 4 is expensive, but 3 I can get used for the cheap.
Yeah.
So he bought that, and I still have a soft spot for 3. There's a lot I like about it, but 4 is clearly better. One of the things 4 did that is really underrated is they doubled the walking speed.
Oh,
Phantasy Stars 2 and 3, you walk kind of slowly, and 4, they just doubled it, and it just makes the game feel so much faster.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. There is something to be said for quick walking speed. I think it's part of the reason why, you know, they gave the thief the ability to run in Final Fantasy V, and then they just made it even faster in the remakes of Final Fantasy V. They're like, why are we slowing people down here?
Yeah, Phantasy Star 4, another thing I like is the battle macro. So instead of punching in the commands to the menu, you just do them ahead of time, and then you can just boom, boom, and have it recreate whatever thing you have. And that makes the battles go pretty quick while still feeling strategic. And that's a system I haven't seen very many other games do. Lunar does to some extent, but it's never quite been the same.
I want to say, like, Lufia 2 does something similar, and maybe one of the Breath of Fire games. I mean, we're getting into the weeds now with the ones that I actually know and have played through.
Yeah.
I didn't have a Sega Genesis growing up. I didn't pick that one up until later. So most of what I have, which I think I have most of the classic Phantasy Stars, I don't have the same attachment to them that I do for the ones that came for the NES and SNES. But I do recognize there is some brilliant construction in the Phantasy Star games. And I mean, just that weird techno vibe that they gave off, that also, like, it's fantasy and, like, medieval, but it has, like, domes and sci-fi texturing to it and other cool stuff. It's a weird series of games.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So.
Oh, man. But, yeah, and the Phantasy Star 4 has these little cutscene kind of things, mm-hmm. where it does still pictures and maybe a brief animation over it.
Yeah.
And that really sold. Like, that's as good as you can get on a console like that. And it really sold it in beautiful work. But one of the pictures is when your spaceship is heading into the station, and they have this nice little background, a nice 16-bit art of a starfield. I just love it. It looks so cool.
It is something interesting that they do, and I think it was like the only other time I can remember, like, in that era, things doing something similar. The Shining Force games had, like, nice little cutscene kind of animations for people talking and so forth. It's an underappreciated aspect that gets you a little more invested in it, because you're not just reading dialogue, you're seeing things that go along with it.
Right. Lunar really did a good job of that, too. The portraits that show... They had a handful of different emotions that the character would show in their text box. And if you haven't played that, the Lunar Silver Star Story Complete and Eternal Blue Complete, I really recommend taking a look at them, because they're a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's sadly a series I missed out on, but I will take your recommendation to look into it. So let's broaden a little further afield. What we talked gaming and we talked programming. Do you have other interests, other things that gather your attention?
In summertime, I like to go road cycling on a bike.
Oh, really? Like, how far afield do you usually tend to go?
So my last summer, I was kind of lazy. I would do 12 miles a day. In the past, I've gone up to 70 miles in a day.
I like that 12 miles a day is lazy. I was sitting there going, man, that sounds like a lot. How long does it take you to bike 12 miles a day?
That's 45 minutes.
Oh, it's not so bad. I do like roller skating myself, and that's about how long I do for a standard, like, just go out there and skate for a little while. So did you say you get up to 70, like 7-0?
Yeah, that's my one day personal record. I decided, I had a crazy goal where I just wanted to ride the bike to every neighboring county. So I ended up riding down south to get into Oswego County here, and I'm in the state of New York.
Okay.
But that's 25 miles each way, so I crossed the county line. Like, oh, good, I'll just turn back and go. Then I decided to take another turn that, in my mind, would be a little shortcut because I was getting tired. Little did I realize I had turned back to the southwest. So I finally reconnected with one of the other roads, and then I looked and, like, wait a minute, how am I still in the town of Ellisburg? And then I had to turn and reconnect. But by the end of the day, I put on an extra 10 miles each way. I got back and I was pretty beat and could barely stand at that point. I actually stopped at a friend's house 12 miles away just to stop and grab a drink before I went the rest of the way back home.
That's a bit much. Oh, wow, though. So, I mean, is it just casual for fun? Have you done any, like, actual, like, distance races or anything with your biking?
I have not.
Okay.
So, what this started as is, growing up, we never had a car. And so, if we had to go anywhere, it was either take the bus or get out on the bike.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older, I just stayed on it. I didn't even get my driver's license until I was 27, just because I saw no need for it. But I would take the bike everywhere, and then since I have one, might as well take it out and do a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And the local bike shop, they do a weekly ride that I was into for a while. And I would ride solidly in the middle of the pack. You got faster people up ahead. You got slow people who are usually way behind. Mm-hmm. But me being in the middle, I'm happy with that.
That's pretty nice.
But those people in the front, those are the ones who show up to the races.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, they're the show-offs right there. So anything else you want to share with us? Any other interesting facts about you, sir?
I do a lot of baking as well.
Do you? Oh, another cooker on the podcast. When I started doing these interviews a couple years ago, I ended up with like two or three people that I was like, man, I need to do a cooking podcast at some point because we're all just talking about food. What kind of stuff do you like to bake?
Usually it's sweets. I've got some banana muffins in front of me right now I made last night. I do a lot of cakes and brownies and cookies and so on. And then I make homemade pizzas about twice a week because I like that a lot.
Oh, with like let's get into the discussion then. But so I'm assuming it's the standard like white kind of crust, not like weird wheat or something.
Yeah, my crust is very boring. Flour, water, salt, yeast, let it rise and take it home.
So what are your pizza toppings then?
Cheese, pepperoni, and my nice plain sauce.
Okay. So pizza toppings can be pretty divisive, I think is probably the right way to put it. A nice pizza, pepperoni and cheese, I'm gonna be behind that one. There are some pizza toppings that I struggle with. Like, I can eat Hawaiian, but I wouldn't say I'm a fan of Hawaiian.
Yeah, I'm somewhat picky, so... Okay. I want exactly what I want and not too much more. I always, if I have to go to a restaurant, I'm never a big fan because you never know what personal touch they want to put on the thing. I'm like, I just want plain bread. And then it's some fancy artisan bread that I'm sure they're very proud of. I'm like, oh, I wanted a plain bread.
So with your baking then, like, what's your favorite, like, sweet flavor then?
Peanut butter chocolate.
Really?
You combine those, and banana chocolate combines pretty well, too. I guess chocolate is the common thread in so many of them.
It's your binding agent there for what you're making.
Oh, yeah. You know, one time I made chocolate chip cookies, and I just kind of spilled the bag in, and it ended up being more like cookie chip chocolates.
I had a friend way back in elementary school that he and his dad... found a chocolate chip cookie, like they were supposed to be like big cookies that they made, and it was like chips plus three different types of nuts and other things, and in every part of the recipe where it called for something like a nut or something else, they just swapped it out with more chocolate chips.
Oh wow.
They called it a super cookie, and I haven't ever tried to recreate the thing, but I will admit it was mostly chip and a lot less cookie.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
a lot of my local friends have gotten to know me for cheesecakes over the last few years. So the first time I made that, it was 2013. Mm-hmm. A friend was leaving and she said, I said, you know, request something, I'll make it. And she said, I want a cheesecake. So then I've never made one before. I don't even really know what it is. I've never even eaten one before.
Yeah.
And so I ended up asking my mother and she's, oh, look, you know, here's how you do it. I went ahead and made one. And then given my pickiness, I'm like, well, I'm not even going to eat one. I'll just make a plain chocolate cake instead. And then a few days later, it's still, there's a couple pieces left in my fridge. And well, I guess I don't want to throw it out, so I guess I'll eat it. I took a bite out of it. I'm like, oh, wow, I see why people like this.
Mm-hmm. It's like an interesting cheesy custard thing in pie form.
Yes.
Yes. So do you just make traditional plain ones, or do you do a variety of flavors for your cheesecakes?
Yeah, I've done quite a variety since then. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites is to take strawberry extract and mix that into the batter. And so it keeps the same smoothness, but gives you that strawberry taste. Mm-hmm. I've also done chocolate ones. For one wedding, I was requested to make a lemon raspberry one. That one, and those are mini cheese. They wanted 500 bite-sized things. That took all day,
Oh, I'm sure.
but it ended up being really quite tasty.
Sounds really good. That's a lovely flavor combination right there. Man, now I'm drooling.
Yeah. Oh, peanut butter cheesecake is a good one too.
I will admit you've hit upon my pickiness there, because I don't really like peanut butter mixed in with other things. So if it's not like on bread, I don't want to eat it. But I can appreciate the people that do like peanut butter and other stuff. And I can see how like the smoothness of the peanut butter would work well with the custardy cheese pie.
Oh, fun fact about the word custard. I just assumed because it rhymes with mustard, it must be, you know, mustardy. And I ended up buying some French vanilla custard ice cream at the store just last year. And I'm like, well, you know, and it's yellow too, so that really bought into my mustard preconceptions. I finally took a bite out of it. I'm like, why did I not buy this a long time ago?
Right.
And talk about judging things by the just what words they rhyme with.
So it's a good pro tip to everyone out there. Custard is not the same as mustard. Well, it's been fun talking to you. It was a good time having you in the booth. This has been Not So Live from Asteroid G. I'm Mike Finkelstein in the booth with Adam ADR from the Final Fantasy Randomizer community. And we will see you guys next time.